From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a Michigan man is out of prison 22 years after he killed a male friend for confessing a same-sex crush on him on the Jenny Jones Show.
If it had been a woman who told him, "I have this secret crush on you," would he have gone and killed her 3 days later? So it's a really tricky case.
Plus, a memoir from the late John Saunders of ESPN, co-authored with our sports commentator, John U. Bacon.
It's not a rah-rah, sports are great, here's my career. This is my life dealing with mental health issues.
And a young farmer talks about his profession.
You know, working that ground, it's that connection to the land, just knowing that you're continuing that tradition of your family and your forefathers, that they did that same thing. You want to be able to give the next generation that same feeling.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. He played hockey at the University of Michigan and Western Michigan University, and then for 3 decades, sports journalist John Saunders was a fixture on ESPN and ABC. Now, a year after his sudden death, comes the unknown story of his lifelong battle with depression.
What John wanted to do was to use his life to sacrifice his own privacy completely to help other people.
Later this hour, Playing Hurt, a memoir co-authored with Michigan Radio sports commentator John U. Bacon. But first, it was a story that dominated headlines in 1995. An Oakland County man named Jonathan Schmitz appeared on the popular Jenny Jones Show. He thought he was going to learn just who had a secret crush on him. Once on stage with cameras rolling, Jenny Jones brought out that secret crush, a gay man named Scott Amador. And here's the moment of the reveal.
Did you think Donna had the crush on you?
Did I? No, we're good friends.
Well, guess what? It's Scott that has the crush on you.
You lied to me.
The videotape of the show, it's excruciating to watch. It never aired. It shows Schmitz with a frozen smile as host Jenny Jones questions him.
Did you have any idea that he liked you this much?
No, I did not.
Can you tell us what your status is? I mean, you involved with anybody or?
No, but I am definitely a heterosexual, I guess you could say.
3 days later, Jonathan Schmitz shot and killed Scott Amador. Today, he was released from prison after 22 years. Michigan Radio's Kate Wells is here with us. This is like something you couldn't even script, isn't it?
Yeah, it is definitely. It is a stranger than fiction true crime story. It's one of those things where Scott Amador and Jonathan Schmitz, they knew each other a little bit. They'd met a couple of times. And Jonathan goes on this show, his lawyers say, thinking that it's going to be his ex-fiance is going to be there, that they've broken up and now they're going to get back together. And she's going to say that she has a crush on him. And for Scott, his parents say that he thought this was going to be this big demonstration of affection and you know, this big demonstration for his crush. And you watch this never-aired episode like you were talking about, and they both come off as nervous, but they handle it pretty well. Like, they're pretty jovial. They keep things pretty light. And then, 3 days later, they go back to Michigan. Jonathan goes on this drinking binge, and apparently he sees on the third day a note from Scott on his car, some sort of like a romantic advance. And Jonathan goes and withdraws money from a savings account. He buys a shotgun and ammunition. He drives over to Scott's trailer. There's a brief confrontation, and Jonathan shoots him twice at close range and then leaves the scene and calls 911 to confess and essentially report the crime.
And you've spoken with attorneys involved in the criminal and civil actions in this case. First is defense attorney Jim Burdick.
Yeah, one of the reasons this case had so much national attention, and one of the reasons that we talk about it now, was both because obviously it had this reality TV tie that, you know, is salacious, and it was sort of a time of like, well, has reality TV gone too far finally? But it also now, when you look back at it, it's one of those instances of the so-called gay panic defense, which became something that was used a lot, not just in the U.S., but in places like Australia, where you could essentially like blame the victim, say, you know, he made an advance at me, he made a pass at me, and I was just so driven to insanity that I overreacted in violence. Now, his attorney, his defense attorney in the criminal trial, Jim Burdick, he says that they didn't use the term gay panic at the time.
He was in a panic that he was being falsely accused or identified as a gay person. And so maybe it meets the criteria of the gay panic defense, although it's not a term that I recall being tossed about at the time.
And for Burdick and his other defense attorneys, really this case was more, they say now, about Schmitz's mental illness, that they say he had untreated bipolar disorder, he'd gone off his meds, and that was really what was going on. But then you also ask the question that, you know, even if he'd gone off his meds, if it had been a woman who told him, I have this secret crush on you, would he have gone and killed her 3 days later? So it's a really tricky case.
Was his excessive reaction based in anything reasonable or rational, or was it engendered by his untreated bipolar disorder? I think the latter is the case.
And Kate, you also spoke with very well-known attorney Jeffrey Feiger. He represented the Amador family in a civil case against the Jenny Jones Show.
Right. So they go, Scott's family sues the Jenny Jones Show and says essentially, you know, none of this would have happened if the Jenny Jones Show hadn't essentially been negligent. And it's really interesting to hear Feiger talk about this because he represented Scott's family, the victim's family, but he describes Jonathan Schmitz, the killer, as almost a victim as well.
I'm convinced Scott Amador would be alive and Jonathan Schmitz would have never hurt him but for that show.
And it did end her career. It totally ended her career. And it did make people look at those shows with different eyes. Talk to us a little about a recent Facebook post from Scott's brother, Frank Amador Jr.
Yeah, so Frank has made a lot of comments about this case now that we know, of course, that Schmitz is being paroled. And we reached out to him on Facebook. We weren't able. He didn't respond to us. We're still hoping to get to talk to him. But he did make a Facebook post about this. And one of the things that he says is the Jenny Jones Show people set Schmitz and Scott up. Schmitz was a victim as well. However, he murdered my brother and deserved to go to prison. There's no excuse for what he did. We have nothing to say about it, though he is being released regardless of how we feel about it.
Now, I covered this story for Detroit Television in 1995. You had not heard of it until this week.
No.
What did you take away from this?
Well, so I came to you at the beginning of this being like, have you heard about this crazy case? And you're like, oh, yeah, I was there and I covered it. What was so interesting to me that this, I'd never heard of the gay panic defense. It blew my mind a little bit that that was something that you could come into court and say, well, he made me uncomfortable because he's gay and I'm straight, and so I killed him. That was a legal defense.
It is something. Michigan Radio's Kate Wells, thanks so much.
Thanks, Cindy.
Stephanie White is the executive director of Equality Michigan with us now. Stephanie, the predecessor of Equality Michigan was the Triangle Foundation. How did its founder, the late Jeff Montgomery, and other gay rights activists respond to that so-called gay panic defense?
Well, they went all in on it. We knew that this was an incredibly dangerous thing for our community to be able to make a case that people were allowed to kill us simply for who we are. He knew exactly very quickly that this was incredibly dangerous and something that needed to be attacked and dismantled as quickly as we could.
And how did he go about that?
Well, I think he did a lot of work to highlight the absurdity of the argument and to get the word out that if this was allowed to stand, that it would essentially say that people were allowed to kill us, that our lives didn't matter if people decided that they were surprised or afraid of us in some way. You know, Jeff Montgomery was a master of media and communications, and he was a loud and proud and unapologetic spokesperson for our community, especially at this time when not a lot of people felt comfortable being so open and loud and public. He was a clear, strong voice for our community, and that meant a lot.
We heard that clip that we played just a bit ago, the audience screeching and howling and cheering when Jonathan Schmitz says, well, I'm definitely heterosexual. All these years later, what do you feel when you hear that?
It's jarring, absolutely. Unfortunately, I wish that it was even more rare. I wish that it wasn't an argument that continued to hold water and continued to find some support in society. It wasn't too long ago that the radio hosts of the show called The Breakfast Club made a joke about finding out that someone was trans and making that be a justification for murder. You know, that was just a few weeks ago. Unfortunately, we still see LGBT people who are victims of hate crimes, and we still see people try to make a justification for those hate crimes based on our identity instead of based on the actions of the perpetrator.
Was that radio host in Michigan?
No, they're a nationally syndicated show. I don't know exactly where they're located. And the show is called The Breakfast Club. The comedian Lil Duval, I think, is the main perpetrator of this joke, who said he found out that someone he was involved with was trans, he thought that would be grounds to kill them.
And when you stop and you think about the fact that this ended in Scott Amador being shot to death, and attorney Jeffrey Feiger, who represented the Amador family in the civil case against the Jenny Jones Show, said to our Kate Wells that Scott Amador dying and Jonathan Schmitz going to prison, he laid that at the feet of the Jenny Jones Show.
Absolutely. I mean, I think she was absolutely, you know, part of setting up the dynamic that put those issues into play, that put those actions into motion.
But as you say, in 2017, I guess the takeaway from revisiting this case for you right now would be?
There's still too many hate crimes. There's still too much violence against our community. And unfortunately, there are still people who have a big microphone who think that it's okay to perpetrate this kind of dangerous myth that LGBT lives aren't worthy of the same respect as everybody else. You know, my takeaway is there's still a lot of work to do. You don't hear the gay panic as often as we used to. We still very often hear about trans panic, and people try to use that as an excuse. And, you know, it's incredibly dangerous to be a trans person, especially a trans person, woman of color in our society. So it's upsetting, and, you know, there's still lots of work to do.
Stephanie White, Equality Michigan. Thanks so much, Stephanie.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Coming up, we talk theater happenings across the state, including a very, very special production of Julius Caesar. Then in 10 minutes, what does the next generation of farmers think about the future of agriculture in our state?
You've got that driving up the land prices, but at the same time, you have really good access for a small farmer to get started. A lot of people looking at that local food movement really want to know their farmers and know where their food comes from.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, and it's time for another edition of Theater Talk as we turn to David Kiley of Encore Michigan to take us around the state looking at productions from professional theater companies. And David, let's start with a last blast of summer Shakespeare, the Pigeon Creek Shakespeare Company, wrapping up the summer at a very special venue.
Yes, Pigeon Creek is on the west side of the state, and they're performing something really special, which is a production of Julius Caesar in the Rose Theater at the Blue Lake Fine Arts Camp, which is in Twin Lake, Michigan, and there's only one performance. So why is it so special? It's because the Rose Theater is a replica of the Elizabethan outdoor theater where Shakespeare's plays were first performed in his time. And I must tell you, I've been there once before. My son did the Shakespeare track at the camp and got to perform there. And I get chills thinking about this and having this really terrific company performing an entire play in this really magical venue.
And even if it rains, you're still good?
It poured rain the day my son was on, and I was mesmerized by the fact that it's an outdoor theater and we were all dry because of this sort of architectural miracle, you know, of just brilliant design.
Well, here's Executive Director Catherine Mayberry as she talks to us about this rare performing space.
In this area, the next closest place you could go to see one of these would be in Virginia. So for people in Michigan to be able to see a performance there is extremely rare. And it's just a beautiful space. And one of the things that we find performing there is that it creates a very special relationship between the actors and the audience, because the audience is surrounding the stage and the performances take place in daylight. So not only can the audience see us, but when we're standing on stage, we can look out and make eye contact with all of those people in the audience, and it really pulls them into the performance.
And doing Julius Caesar, you say this is one of Shakespeare's most accessible plays?
Yeah, I have always found it because people are so familiar with the story at this point. It's so often taught in schools as opposed to some of the other plays. And it's got violence and it's got all the good stuff that people kind of gravitate to at the movie theaters now. So that's why I think it's perhaps the most accessible.
Well, here's Catherine Mayberry again talking about this choice of doing Julius Caesar at the Rose Theater.
Julius Caesar is a play where the audience can be really highly involved because there are all of these crowd scenes and these famous speeches like Antony's friends, Romans, countrymen, that the characters are actually giving to a crowd. And the Rose is a perfect place to get the audience involved in that way and sort of turn them into the citizens of Rome and have the characters interact with them.
So again, that's this Saturday, one performance of Julius Caesar by the Pigeon Creek Shakespeare Company at the Rose Theater at the Blue Lake Fine Arts Camp in Twin Lake. Over the midsection of Michigan to Milan, it's the second annual Crooked Tree Play Festival. Now, what's happening and who's behind this?
Well, this is a creation of the Roustabout Theater Company. They'll be doing live readings of new plays by six different Michigan-born or Michigan-resident playwrights. And it's organized by Joe Zettelmeyer, who is one of Michigan's best and most prolific playwrights. And the readings takes place in shops and public spaces and downtown Milan. And that takes place on Friday, August 25th, starting at 5 p.m., and Saturday, August 26th, starting at 3 p.m.
So interesting to bring a theatrical experience out to the people rather than having people coming into a theater space. In fact, here's playwright Joseph Zettelmeyer talking about that very fact.
The founders of Roustabout Theater and I have all been working in the professional Michigan theater community for many years. And in that time, we've seen the benefit of bringing the arts to small towns. We saw Chelsea change when the Purple Rose Theater opened. We saw Williamston Theater change when Williamston Theater opened. We've seen the way that arts bring a great deal of life to a community, and we really like the idea of traveling to multiple locations to try and, you know, spread the theater love, as it were, to as many different places as possible.
And they put out a call to Michigan playwrights.
Yes, it's excellent. I'm actually in a play festival like this right now, and it's fantastic to see all of these local writers getting their work done on stage.
And I know Joe said they got 18 plays, and they had to narrow it down to five traditional theater scripts and one children's script.
One of the things we're really proud about this year is it's a wide variety of scripts. We've got two romantic comedies, a children's play, a horror play, a fairy tale, and a historical drama.
Tons of fun. That does sound really, really great. Now we go to Pinckney for the, I love this title, The Great American Trailer Park Musical.
Yes, something funny, a little bit silly. There are a few of these trailer park musicals in a series. This is the original one. They are very funny, and the cast assembled at the Dio for this one is quite good. And I must say that casting is especially important with this show. I mean, casting is always important, but it's really important with this show because it's the talent of the actors, more so than other shows, that kind of elevates this kind of comedy almost beyond the silliness of the script. The plot is kind of almost immaterial. it's really about a small group of folks living in a trailer park, kind of living up to that stereotype.
Let's take a quick listen to a clip from the cast album.
Is this the right side of the track? That we live this side of the tracks. We live this side of the tracks. Where it's hotter than Hades. And in a heat like this, it's hard to act like ladies when you're this side of the tracks.
That does sound like a lot of fun. A perfect summer theater experience.
Mm-hmm.
Over to Augusta and the Barn Theater.
The Barn is closing out their summer season with Rent. Everybody knows Rent at this point, I would think. It's a cult musical that began in New York City about a group of people struggling through the AIDS crisis on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. The music and dance is pretty unforgettable, which is why it's a cult musical. And I expect the Barn to do a great job with this.
And now we go to Ferndale to the Slipstream Initiative.
Mm-hmm. They're producing a new play written by a young actor and writer named Maxim Vinogradov, which focuses somewhat on the life of playwright Tennessee Williams. And this young writer, who is a student, won the Hopwood Award at the University of Michigan for this play. And he won last year's Wild Award in Michigan for Best Rising Star, which is given each year to the actor with the best performance in a professional production reviewed by Encore Michigan. And that opens August 26th at the Slipstream in Ferndale. And just a little plug, this year's Rising Star Award is sponsored by the law firm of Kerr Russell. And I wanted to drop that in because they're a sponsor of theater now statewide with us. And that kind of is a final reminder for anyone interested. The Wild Awards are coming up this Monday, August 28th at 8 o'clock. The doors open at 6:30 for cocktail hour and networking. It's open to the public. So if you're a big theater fan and you want to get kind of an overview, kind of a retrospective on this past season and see wonderful entertainers, the best, I mean, we have our nominated actors and actresses who are singing. Please come. You can get the ticket information at Encore Michigan. And I hope to be back with this year's Rising Star winner. I think it would be nice for our audience to hear from this year's Rising Star.
Very good. And as you've described it to us, like the Michigan Tony Awards.
Pretty much, yes.
David Kiley of Encore Michigan. You can get details on these and other productions and the Wild Awards. Just go to EncoreMichigan.com. David, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Cynthia.
It's an ancient way of life under 21st century economic pressures. According to the state's numbers, the food and agriculture industry pumps $101 billion into Michigan's economy every year. It employs some 923,000 people. That's nearly a quarter of Michigan's workforce. So what does the next generation of farmers think about the future of agriculture in our state? Mark Matthey runs a small dairy and cattle farm in Ida. He's the VP of the Monroe County Farm Bureau, where he's the young farmer representative. Welcome, Mark. Tell me about your farm. What do you raise and how big is it?
Well, we farm in Ida. We raise beef cattle, sheep, and chickens for both meat and eggs. We're on about 11 acres. We have about a half a dozen cattle, about a dozen sheep right now. We're still kind of building our farm and getting started. In addition, my wife has an in-home daycare. I also have the fortune to work with my dad and my uncle and my cousins on their farm, about 1,400 acres of cash grain, corn, soybeans, and winter wheat in LaSalle.
So you did grow up in a farming family?
That's correct. Both my wife and I did grow up in farm families, and it's something that we really want to have our next generation. We have a 2-year-old daughter, Lauren, something that we want her to grow up in with those same kinds of experiences that we did growing up.
Now, do you have another job apart from farming?
I do. I'm actually a civil engineer, work for Manikin Smith Group in Monroe. Actually do quite a bit of work with our municipalities. So company I work for, we do a lot of township engineering, road programs, utility work. We actually operate Dundee Wastewater Treatment Plant in addition.
Would you like to be able to do farming full time?
Well, if the opportunity presented itself, that would certainly be my number one goal. My dad told me, you know, go away to college, get a degree, come back, get a job, pay the bills. The farm will always be here. It's something you can always do, but you want to have that. You want to have a solid stream of income. Over time, we're trying to build some equity, build some capital, and eventually look to expand. But right now, we're starting with a few livestock.
You use that phrase, if the opportunity presented itself. So what would it take for you to be able to take that step and embrace farming full time?
You know, one of the biggest, I guess, concerns that we see facing us is access to land and capital. Being able to, over time, build enough equity in our farm and in our operation to eventually expand and really get going on a larger scale for growing grain or really expanding the livestock side of the business. That's something that is one of our bigger challenges looking forward.
Because I've got to wonder, you know, you think of farming in this country, in Michigan, let's say in the late 1800s. There it was. There was lots of it. Today, you've got subdivisions moving out. You've got, you know, shopping strips going up. Is that part of the challenge, is that there just isn't the contiguous land that there would have been for, say, your grandparents?
Yeah, that's a big thing. One of the things that we had, you know, not too long ago was real high commodity prices. So that really drove up the price of land, especially when you're looking at large pieces of ground. That was, you know, a major concern. Land, you know, commodity prices have retreated a little bit since then, and that poses another challenge, you know, getting started in farming. If you don't have really strong commodity prices, you really don't have a good margin to work off of.
And when for non-farmers, when you say commodity prices, meaning what?
That's like the price for a bushel of corn or the price for, you know, chickens or cows when you take them to market.
So basically how much money you can squeeze out of that acre of land for whatever it is you're raising. So as that goes up and down, that affects your ability to be able to either buy it or else be able to get a return on your investment.
That's right.
And I have to imagine the equipment would curl our hair to hear how much some of this costs.
Yeah.
What would be, if you wanted to get into grain, which you say you do, so what would you need equipment-wise and what might it cost?
It really depends. You can go a couple of different ways. You could either go kind of older, smaller equipment and work a smaller amount of ground, or if you really wanted to go big,
that's kind of one of the things about going big is there's so much technology in the business. The technology really kind of pays for itself, especially with the larger equipment. But to get started, if you were going to go and take your open checkbook and go write a check to the dealership, you're looking at a couple $100,000 easy. And that's on top of the land. You know, you got to think, and depending on where you are, land prices are very variable. And of course, more fertile ground is priced a little bit higher, but you know, you can't do a whole lot about that. And like you said, the development pressure, that's a huge thing, especially where we are. You know, we're situated between a couple of major residential areas, Detroit and Toledo and Ann Arbor. It's a blessing and it's a curse. You know, you've got that driving up of land prices, but at the same time, you have really good access for a small farmer to get started. A lot of people looking at that local food movement really want to know their farmers and know where their food comes from. It's a lot of opportunity, but at the same time, you know.
Who do you sell to? Who's your customer?
We actually sell direct to market. You know, we have a couple of consumers that are neighbors, family, friends, people that I know through work. And that's really our major clientele for the beef and the lamb and the eggs and chicken.
When you think about the future of agriculture and of farming in Michigan, what do you see? Because you're the generation that's going to move it into the 21st century.
I think that local food movement is really going to drive a lot of the process. At the same time, Michigan is kind of experiencing a revitalization and a rebirth. You know, after the 2008 economic kind of crunch, we don't have that same type of manufacturing job, but Michigan has a lot of opportunities for agricultural processing, you know, taking that crop or that product and adding value to it through processing. Either, like Michigan's a huge producer of pickling cucumbers. You know, we grow cucumbers really well for making into pickles. So it's that value-added process, like turning soybeans into soybean oil, soybean meal, biodiesel, corn into ethanol. It's adding value to your crop. In Michigan, you know, we have access to all these great transportation opportunities. We're right on all the Great Lakes, Class 1 railroads, highways, interstates. We're situated right near a lot of the population in the country. We're really really well poised for a lot of expansion in processing.
Is there a communal spirit, just for lack of a better phrase, among farmers from all over Michigan? I mean, I'm wondering, do those of you who farm in Southeast Michigan, for instance, feel a solidarity or share notes or ideas with farmers from the Thumb or from the North Country or from Southwest Michigan?
Yeah, it's a really tight-knit group. You know, there's so few farmers. It's less than 2% of the population. But at the same time, we all share similar problems. We might not all grow the same commodities or the type of livestock, but we share, you know, in changing commodity prices, difficulty in moving your products to market.
I'm wondering, when it comes to jobs, let's say someone's living in an area where there are farms. Are there jobs to be had for someone who wants to be involved in agriculture but not fully jump into owning a farm?
Yeah, that's a really good question. There's a lot of opportunity. Right now, we're looking at between 50 and 60,000 jobs each year that aren't filled in the ag realm. You know, not just farming, not just boots on the ground in the fields, but all of those processing channels, you know, applying fertilizer to the fields or working on these dairies, big dairies, picking crops and commodities, things like that. And a lot of those jobs, even like welding, repairing, mechanic work. A lot of those jobs are really skilled work, well-paying jobs. And it's something that we've actually been working on around our community as far as working with Monroe County Community College to bring a Michigan State University two-year ag degree down here so that our students can stay close to home, get qualified to work in these really good-paying jobs and fill some of those opportunities.
Let's talk about, because we hear that farmers, we've talked to farmers before as the whole immigration debate goes on. Yeah. Labor's an issue for Michigan farmers, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is a big problem. Not so much around here because we see a lot of grain around here, but in labor-intensive jobs, picking apples, picking asparagus, these jobs that require a lot of hand work. The immigration debate, that's a big concern for Farm Bureau and for farmers in general, that we need to make sure that we have legal workers here at the right time. And that's part of the problem with the immigration program as it is right now, is we can move workers through the process, but if they don't arrive on time, you might miss that harvest window, or if you might not get a crop in the ground on time. And I mean, that's a big concern when you do a lot of your work in a very narrow window.
When you think of a really perfect day, when you are just in your moment, in your happy place as a farmer, tell us what that's like.
Just sitting on a tractor, heading down the field, just thinking about, you know, working that ground, that it's that connection to the land, being able to have that connection. Just knowing that you're continuing that tradition of your family and your forefathers, that they did that same thing, and you want to be able to give the next generation that same feeling, take care of the land, take care of the water.
And you're hoping your daughter picks up on this family tradition.
Oh, yeah, yeah. She's already, that's one of her favorite things, is playing with the little baby lambs, playing, feeding calves. It's a great opportunity. It really gives her a connection, and it's something that more people should, quite frankly, have that opportunity to come out and see.
Mark Matthey runs a small farm in Ida. He's the vice president of the Monroe County Farm Bureau, where he is the Young Farmer Representative. Thank you so much for sharing your work with us.
It was my pleasure. Really appreciate the opportunity.
And up next, before his sudden death a year ago, ESPN host John Saunders finally opened up about his lifelong battle with depression. His story after the break. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. He was a welcome presence on ESPN and ABC for decades.
Thank you for watching Outside the Lines. Coming up next, John Saunders and the Sports Reporters.
Thank you, Steve. I'm John Saunders, and these are the Sports Reporters.
During his 30 years at ESPN, John Saunders lived every sports fan's dream job.
The NCAA has stood firm, saying paying players from the money they generate would ruin college athletics. But room, board, books, and tuition are hard to reconcile against the billions of dollars the NCAA hauls in. That's where they may be in trouble. There are laws in every walk of life that protect workers from being exploited. And even if you don't think that applies here, you can't argue. Someone's doing all the work, and someone else is getting all the money.
But even as this one-time Western Michigan University hockey player rose to become one of the country's most popular sportscasters, he secretly battled depression, and he endured personal traumas that are hard to believe. John Saunders finally chose to share his painful battles with depression. He chose to do it through a book, Playing Hurt, My Journey from Despair to Hope, co-written with his friend and ours, Michigan Radio sports commentator John U. Bacon. And when Saunders died suddenly 1 year ago in August 2016, it was left to John U. Bacon to carry the torch and tell his friend's story. Good to have you here to talk about this, but it's tough. It's a painful, painful read, I got to tell you.
Undeniably so. John spares nothing in this book, and in this book, he will talk about, he does not ask for pity or sympathy. That was important to me. It's not melodramatic, but it's also not being cute. He talks about physical abuse from his father, sexual abuse from his older female cousins, which John was 6 or 7 at the time. And even the kids in high school, by the way, I learned a lot in this book. I don't suffer from any of these things, and you know, knock on wood, lucky. But even that, for example, when you hear these stories about these high school kids who are having an affair with a 25-year-old high school teacher, we joke in the locker room, hockey locker room, you know, that guy doesn't need counseling, he's a high five. You know, that's the usual mindset. Those guys get messed up for the same reason John did, that sex becomes physical only, not emotional. It's shameful. It's something you keep to yourself. It's mechanical. And that carried with John throughout his relationships. And then you throw on top of that self-mutilation, which is normally associated with teenage girls, self-medication, both using and dealing drugs through high school. Then, of course, depression is the umbrella on top of all of it. So
and
that's
that depression battle. Well, he opens his book with a truly chilling description of driving up to the Tappan Zee Bridge in New York. Tell us what happened.
So, yeah, the story starts with John looking over the side of the Tappan Zee Bridge in New York and considering suicide. And he promised himself that he would only go to the bridge if he would not jump, just kind of case the joint. But he said, as you climb over some of the beams and whatnot, he said he felt a strong hand at his back. You know, clearly wanted him to go that direction. And he said what turned him around was not any nobility or the like, it was fear. That looking down at what looks like concrete, which water is at that height, he said he did not have the guts to do it, frankly. So that's an alarming way to start the book off, but that tells the reader this is not your average ESPN book. And talking to Mitch Albom about this, he said, you know, I've read plenty of sports biographies. I've read nothing like this, and he was nice enough to give us a foreword for this book. It's not a rah-rah, sports are great, here's my career. This is my life dealing with mental health issues.
And before we talk about what led to this lifelong battle with depression for John Saunders, tell us, how did you come aboard with doing this book with him?
Partly dumb luck, actually. John had been friends since 1998 or so. I was dressing at Joe Louis Arena for Dave Coulier's hockey celebrity media thing, whatever. To my left are the Hansen brothers from Slapshot, the movie, and they're, of course, put on the foil with the glasses on. They're caricatures. To my right is John Saunders, played at Western, played at Michigan, serious player. I'm getting dressed in the locker room, and John's next to me, and we just started chatting. And we stayed friends throughout this whole time. We're going to do a book on Madison Square Garden when he stood up too soon at ABC College Football, blacked out on the set, probably due to his diabetes, falls backwards. And John's a big guy. He's 6'2", 235, somewhere in there. And when he fell back, he hit his head so hard that blood was shooting out the back of his head, I mean, firing. And he went to the hospital thinking, okay, hockey guy, I'll get a few stitches and we'll
shrug
be fine.
Off.
Exactly right. We'll walk it off. John ends up at Mount Sinai in New York for 6 weeks, relearning how to walk and talk and read and write. And this guy's got an IQ of 154. Very bright guy, to say the least. It had been reduced to 102, which is, you know, barely getting by. 10 pegs into 10 holes. It took him 6 minutes to do it. And, I mean, we'll do that in 10 seconds, obviously, or less. So that's how bad he was. One of John's points about the whole concussion thing going on is that concussions themselves do not actually give you depression. That's a myth. Losing your faculties, your short-term memory, your ability to think rationally, which happens with these concussions, that can make you depressed. You're afraid it might not ever come back. And if you're John Saunders and you do what you do,
yep,
which is you got three guys in your ear, and it's a lot harder than it looks, and John had three records going on in his head at one time during a broadcast. You got the producer, the guest, the thing is scrolling. It's a hard job, actually. It looks like fun, but it's quite hard. If those records get scratched, and John's records were scratched at that point, that job becomes very difficult. And John could always rely on being a top dog, one of the top three or four at ESPN for 30 years. And now you've lost it. Can you get it back? He doesn't know.
And the clouds are there. He takes us so deeply into that experience. So suddenly, a book about Madison Square Garden becomes less important.
Looks pretty small.
But his depression and the battles that he fought through his life and the things that happened to him, nobody really knew that. Very, very few people. So led to him saying, all right, I'm going to write this book, Playing Hurt, and I want you to be with me on it, and we're going to tell them a story. What unlocked that for
him? Couple things. One, the book I wrote with Bo Schembechler, and he knew Bo quite well, naturally. Bo's Lasting Lessons. He liked that book. He also liked the fact that it sounds like Bo, not like me, which takes about 5 drafts, people. That's also harder than it looks. But he wanted it to be his book. He trusted me. We had a good rapport. He had talked to me about some of this, not all of it by a long shot, his background. But I knew more than most, and I did not run scared or freak out, I guess. So we started doing it. And we did it in this about 3 months after he went to the bridge, and things were a lot better by then. But he came here to Ann Arbor 3 or 4 times to sit down. 2 or 3 times, I guess, for 3 or 4 days each, to go over all this stuff. And each time your jaw drops. You just can't believe this guy went through all, you can't believe anybody went through all this. And almost any mental health issue out there right now, John probably went through, as I just discussed. And yet, the incredible thing is, I loved sitting down with John. He is such a good guy. He's a great husband, great father, and he's terrified about being a bad father like his dad was. And he's a wonderful father, and his daughters now in their 20s are people you'd want to be around. They're just wonderful people who love their daddy, as they always call them, never dad, daddy, very much. John and I, sitting in at the house in Ann Arbor, his place in New York, or in a hotel sometimes, or agent's offices, we did it all for 5 years, he would make me laugh every 15 or 20 minutes talking about the worst stuff on earth. And I don't know how he did it. And it was not inappropriate. I guess
Yes. Sometimes
it might have been a little bit.
Sure, sure.
But in this book, hopefully every 10 or 15 pages, you will still actually laugh. John never lost his sense of humor. And if you don't lose it through all that, you never will. And I miss him on top of that.
Yeah, I bet. Well, I'd like if you would, John Ubacon, to please read us an excerpt from Playing Hurt. And this is going to give everybody a sense of what it was like to be John Saunders with this father.
This is about his dad, of course, who was his baseball coach, tough guy to say the least. And this is at her bidding, by the way. She picked this one out. Cindy, that is. He was not afraid to dress me down in public, but more frequently, his punishments were meted out in private. If he told me to do something and I hesitated or questioned his order, he would furrow his eyebrow, which created a crease across the bridge of his nose. Then he'd slowly narrow his eyes as if sizing up his prey. I knew what was coming next, so I'd start to run. usually for the perceived safety of my room. But that was not very smart, because then I was trapped. So I'd grab pillows to protect myself against the blows I knew were coming. When I was younger, he'd hit me with an open hand, usually on any part of my body that I'd failed to protect. I'd duck and dodge and try not to cry. But pulling that off was almost impossible when the guy you thought was Superman had reduced you to a squirming lump of fear. The older I got, the harder he hit me. When I was around 12 years old, my father had returned after a few weeks away and started giving us all chores to do. I unwisely suggested that, because he was not around much anymore, he no longer had any right to tell me what to do. And that's when I saw the all-too-familiar furrowed brow and squinting eyes. This time, the open hand became a fist. When he started punching me, naturally I clenched my hands as if preparing to punch him back. This only enraged him more, and he punched me even harder. As an added humiliation, he punctuated every blow with a cutting remark. "Why can't you learn to keep your mouth shut? This is your own fault. Why are you so dumb?" Long after the bumps and bruises faded, what stayed with me was a deep, unshakable feeling of worthlessness. Despite all the beatings, I never thought my father was the problem. Instead, I concluded that I deserved them because I must have been a horrible kid. And Cindy, I've not read this since I turned the last draft in a few months ago.
Yeah.
And I did not know I was going to do this today. And I'm Christ. Choked up because I can hear him.
Saying this to
and
you.
I can see him. He was calmer saying these things to me than I was listening to them.
It made me cry as I read it. And there are many other instances where this happens. And you say this warm, wonderful human being that Americans welcomed into their living rooms eagerly for 30 years was able to overcome that. And he didn't tell people for the most part. He did seek psychiatric help at some point.
Crucially. And look, there's one message to this book, and get it loud and clear. Two messages, sorry. One is depression is a disease. You cannot just say buck up and get through it. And
come on, you've got a great life. You've got a dream job.
Cheerleading, we call it in the book. It doesn't help. It's like trying, as we say in the book, it's like trying to cure cancer with cold medicine. It's a different issue. You need to go see a doctor. You need to see doctors, and you get medication in many cases, therapy and so on. Second of all, though, you get help. It works. The success rate here at Michigan, the Depression Center with Dr. John Graydon and others, the success rate is very, very high, 80, 90%, depends on how you define it, of course. But this is almost always a treatable condition. So the reason we pushed through the last year without John, it wasn't the money, it wasn't this or that, because I made him a promise, and so did Wanda, his wife, and his brother Bernie, that what John wanted to do was to use his life to sacrifice his own privacy completely to help other people. And as Mitch Albom says in the foreword, he planned on living and spreading this message. So we are doing that now.
He was going to talk about all of this.
Eagerly.
Absolutely.
And better than I can.
Something else that really struck me is what John Saunders experienced as a man of color. He grew up outside Montreal where things were inclusive and relaxed. But
right.
Talk to us a little about what happened when John came to Indiana to play hockey.
Yeah. Indiana's not known for his hockey, of course. They had a good club team back then, about to go varsity, they thought. John goes to the dorm at Indiana, and his roommate walks in with his mom and dad, big lineman on the football team, big white guy from southern Indiana. And I'm not going to use it here,
no.
But he says, "I can't believe I'm rooming with an N-word."
Oh.
And not even saying it to John, but saying it to his parents as though he's not there.
Because John put his hand out. "Hi, I'm John."
Even the mom wouldn't take it. So at that point, he realizes this place is not going to be for me. I can't do this. So he transfers back to Michigan, where Dan Farrell, the coach, first-year coach, then eagerly picks him up at the bus stop. He's a walk-on, not a scholarship player. Getting along great with his teammates from Toronto, many of them. Not a big race thing there, of course, on the team. And now it's the black students, actually, where the problem lies for John. He's walking down the sidewalk with his hockey buddies, two white dudes, and two African-American female students are walking towards him. And they both nod to John, and John's from Canada. He does not know the code. And probably if you're a black student at Michigan in the 70s, you'd know this. You are to nod to express solidarity, that we're all in this together, and I see you and you see me.
He didn't know the social cue.
Didn't know it. So he does not nod. They turn around on him and say all kinds of things, but basically your cracker friends aren't going to help you. You're not better than we are, and so on. And then eventually guys in his dorm, black guys, which is what John called himself, by the way, pull him into a dorm room and basically beat the hell out of him.
So then he went to Western.
Then he goes to Western, and now he does not have a racist roommate, and he knows the code on campus, so he knows to nod. He's now an American in that sense, so it works out very well for him at Western.
How did, as you worked on Playing Hurt with John, how did having to dive into some very terrible memories for the greater good of helping people, how did that affect him? Was it cathartic? Was it painful?
That's a great question, and one I was deeply concerned about because, look, I'm a history major, sports writer. This is not my field. I am utterly unqualified to analyze the medical aspects of this. So I said to John and to Juan, I said, look, you're talking to your doctor now. I'll do one session with you, you know, one writing session, and see how it feels and all that. But then you have to ask if this is a good idea or a bad idea. And I said throughout this long process, 4 years, if at any point, even after we have a contract, this is not in your best interest in any way, we'll eat the money, we'll pull the plug, whatever. The deal had to be like that. It had to be John coming to me because you cannot prod anybody to write a book like this. And I had to have John's back in that sense. But his doctors were very clear early on that this is actually doing him a lot of good. He's very excited about it. It's the thing he's looking forward to most, actually. He's thinking about a career in writing post-TV. And he would have had one, no question about it. And I will say I was very gratified when John's telling me about his dad. And I say, you know what? He only knocks you down after one of your best moments, after he wins the Little League championship, after he gets a cool house, a great job. That's always when he brings him down. And he passed that on to his doctor, and I'm pleased to report his doctor said, oh, he's good. And I only say that because I was so terrified of this screwing him up. And once I heard that from her, I said, okay, I'm not a psychiatrist, not a psychologist, I'm not any kind of professional, but this is doing him good, not bad, so let's keep going.
Well, I would say anyone who reads Playing Hurt will not walk away indifferent. The inside is spectacular. I'm sure for you, what an emotional exercise with John having died and not being able to share the story as he planned, but you're the guy doing it.
Bittersweet, heavy on the bitter. It's heartbreaking that John's not here. This was his victory lap, not mine. And I was so looking forward. And I was telling John about this. Man, when this book's out there, the world's going to give you a big bear hug. You're going to be validated for going through all this. They're going to tell you it wasn't you. It was your parents. It was these other situations. And, John's only getting that his legacy is. But I am gratified. The reaction already to this has been extraordinarily positive from ESPN, from colleagues, from reviewers. It's hitting the spot that we needed to hit.
The book is Playing Hurt, My Journey from Despair to Hope by the late John Saunders, co-authored by our Michigan Radio Sports commentator, John Eubacon. Thanks so much, John.
Cindy, thank you.
And John Eubacon will be talking about Playing Hurt in Ann Arbor at Literati Bookstore Thursday, September 14th at 7 p.m. Tomorrow on Stateside, the Civil War saw tens of thousands of Michiganders join up to preserve the Union and put an end to slavery. But did you know about Company K?
Several Anishinaabek were mortally wounded, and as they were realizing their fate, they gathered in a circle to chant their death song.
We'll learn about Michigan's Native American sharpshooting outfit that fought in the Civil War. And today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia and engineered by Peg Watson. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mike Blank, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.